Hello, welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader from Flagstaff, Deborah McFadder, with excerpts from Yes Media, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. Today we start with an interesting title, Apocalypse Chow, Don't Let Corporations Define Vegetables. It's by Aaron Gupta, first published March 13th, 2025. The drawing at the beginning shows sliced sections of different fruits and vegetables, cucumbers, oranges, pineapple, tomato, lime, and it has in white letters across it, Apocalypse Chow. Yes Media is excited to present a new column, Apocalypse Chow, by Aaron Gupta, investigative reporter, French-trained chef, food tour guide, and author of the forthcoming eponymous book, Apocalypse Chow, A Junk Food-Loving Chef Explains How America Created the Most Revolutionary Food System Ever. The New Press is the publisher. This monthly column will explore how our tastes are shaped by social forces and how the mundane parts of our lives, cars, social media, industrialization, office jobs, and more, shape what we eat. By understanding why we love junk food, we can remake our food culture to focus on what's tastier, has greater variety, and is healthier for ourselves and the planet. In Gupta's inaugural column, he explores how corporations have redefined what a vegetable is and how that is impacting our health. There is no sager dietary advice than eat your vegetables. A parent has probably told you this countless times. It's also the mantra of Michael Pollan, which he turned into multiple best-selling books, Eat Food, Not Too Much, Mostly Plants. Nutrition experts have been telling us to eat more fresh produce for so long, they sound like a weary parent. However, it turns out, vegetables are making us fat. The more servings of vegetables we eat, the more calories we consume. That's the startling conclusion of a 2014 United States Department of Agriculture, USDA, report titled, Healthy Vegetables Undermined by the Company They Keep, which concluded that when we eat one cup of a particular vegetable, read on to find out which one, in a restaurant, we rack up 364 more calories than if we didn't eat it. To understand why requires a brief primer in nutrition. We need fruits and vegetables to thrive. They provide water, fiber, vitamins, minerals, and phytochemicals. They have a lot of bulk, but are low in calories, so they help us avoid sugary, salty, fatty snacks. Pickled produce such as cabbage, mango, radish, and cucumbers delivers probiotics for gut health. Most importantly, eating lots of fruits and vegetables can help us live longer. In the clinical language of government scientists, fruit and vegetable intakes were associated with reduced risk of cardiovascular disease, cancer, and all-cause mortality. Nearly everyone is familiar with the five-a-day recommendation for fruits and vegetables. Harvard Medical School, the World Health Organization, and even the Texas state government agree we should eat five servings a day. That means half a cup of food such as blueberries, cucumbers, broccoli, carrots, or apples. For greens such as spinach, kale, cabbage, or lettuce, a serving is one packed cup of raw leaves or a half cup of cooked greens. A half cup of cooked pulses, such as beans, chickpeas, peas, and lentils, also counts as a serving. In 2014, Americans ate, on average, 2.51 cups of fruits and vegetable a day, or five servings, according to the USDA. It sounds like we are meeting our goals, but all is not what it seems. One problem is the real minimum is three servings of fruit and four servings of vegetables a day, per the U.S. National Cancer Institute. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only 10% of adults eat this amount of fruit or vegetables. But even seven servings a day is misleading. That's what a petite, sedentary, 85-year-old woman should eat. The first problem is many of us should eat 10 or more servings a day, as I will explain. Because we are so far below 10 a day, the advice to eat 5 servings is a form of harm reduction. Nutrition experts are encouraging us to eat 1 or 2 more servings a day rather than discouraging us by admitting we are falling far short of our minimum needs. The second issue is we also need a variety of vegetables. Every day we should have a serving of dark leafy greens, a red or orange vegetable, such as tomato or sweet potato, and lentils, peas, or beans. Virtually no one eats these foods every day. The third problem is the type of vegetables we eat regularly, how they are prepared, and what accompanies them. Related to this is the problem of what the USDA considers a serving of a fruit or a vegetable. Here's the rub. We average about 3 servings of vegetables a day, and potatoes and tomatoes make up a majority of that. Potatoes almost always come loaded with fat, calories, and sodium, such as fries, chips, mashed, scalloped, or gratin. Baked potatoes are healthier, but spuds are typically swimming in butter, cheese, sour cream, and bacon. Tomatoes are even worse. We may think we usually enjoy them on a refreshing salad with a drizzle of extra virgin olive oil, but in reality, we eat tomatoes as salsa, ketchup, and sauces in cheesy pizza, meaty lasagna, stuffed burritos, loaded nachos, thick hamburgers, and greasy fries. That's why for every cup of tomatoes we eat in restaurants, we pack on an extra 364 calories. Eliminate potatoes and tomatoes, and Americans eat less than 1 cup of vegetables a day, and there is no guarantee it's healthy. It might be creamed spinach, broccoli with cheese sauce, or greens piled with meat and cheese and slicked with oil. Adding fat to vegetables is a strategy in the restaurant industry. Vegetables can be made tasty, healthy, and low fat, such as those roasted, but such methods are labor intensive. Instead, restaurants have adopted the mantra, when in doubt, add bacon and cheese. These ingredients are taxpayer subsidized, packed with flavor, and require little added labor, which makes them high profit. But we end up ingesting excessive amounts of butter, bacon, and cheese, only adding to the restaurant's bottom line and our waistline. Our diets have worsened since the USDA's 2014 report. Vegetable consumption has steadily declined since 2003, dropping from more than 400 pounds annually per capita to about 350 pounds in 2022. This is largely a result of social conditions. The Great Recession, the pandemic, and inflation have pushed more people into poverty, even as food, especially fresh produce, rises in cost. The situation is just as bad for fruit. That's because the USDA considers juice a serving, which accounts for more than 35% of our fruit intake. Sure, 100% fruit juice has vitamins and minerals, but it can have as much sugar as soda, and it's the added free sugars that are most harmful to our health. Another 10% of our fruit intake is canned or dried, and it's a good bet they have added sugar as well. Remove potatoes, tomatoes, and fruit juice, and Americans eat barely 2.5 servings of fruit and vegetables a day on average. And even that may be overstating it. How did our diets get so bad, and how can we improve them? The main problem is corporations hold sway over our food system and our lives, from work and housing to family and leisure. Agribusiness fruits and vegetables are expensive. They are grown thousands of miles from our tables, expensive to transport and store, and cost far more per calorie than energy-dense and heavily subsidized commodities such as beef, cheese, wheat, and sugar. Since we are time and money stressed, we eat subsidized foods in the form of ultra-processed fast food and junk food that give us a moment of satisfaction at the cost of a lifetime of illness. The solution is simple. remove the profit motive so workers and communities own and operate farms, kitchens, grocers, and restaurants. This would allow us to mine our vast culinary history to match food cultures with local communities, tastes, and bioregions. Food cooked daily from fresh ingredients in small batches is mostly found in immigrant or high-end restaurants, as it requires skill and labor. Such restaurants often exploit workers, but we could redirect tens of billions in agricultural subsidies that benefit food giants to subsidize local systems with cuisines that are far more delicious than corporate food while being healthy and low cost. Of course, we need to build a constituency and political power to have any hope of creating food systems free of capitalist rot. In the meantime, how do we get more fresh produce every day? I tried one method after stumbling on an online calculator created by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in 2013. Based on age, exercise, and gender, it told me how many fruits and vegetables I should eat. Forget five a day. As a male in my 40s who exercised more than 1 hour a day, I had to eat 12 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. For my partner, Michelle, who is similarly active, it was 10 servings a day. That calculator has disappeared, but there is a similar one at myplate.gov. I was stunned. Having cooked professionally, I knew that meant shopping, prepping, cooking, cleaning, and storing 154 portions of fruits and vegetables a week. I tried it for several months. It took me 25 hours a week or more, almost a full-time job. But I discovered something interesting. When I ate more than 8 servings of produce a day, I shifted to a plant-based diet. I was eating fewer chips and cold cuts and more salads, beans, pickles, fresh fruit smoothies, and stir fries. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. Don't forget that you can get our stream and on-demand programs with our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Continuing with the article, Apocalypse Chow. Even though I work from home, spending so much time cooking wasn't a realistic solution for me, much less for families with kids and those who don't have professional skills and equipment. The most important morsel of knowledge for healthier eating is understanding what motivates food choices. Taste, convenience, speed, predictability, and cost determine what we eat. We hit the drive-thru because we know and like how that fried chicken sandwich tastes. It is relatively cheap. The location is convenient, as is eating. It can be done with one hand while driving. And it's quick to order, cook, eat, and clean up. Obesity-related diseases have risen sharply as eating out has soared. Over a 40-year period, beginning in the late 1970s, eating out increased more than 70%, and fast food visits nearly tripled. Knowing this, eat at home as much as possible. Minimally processed foods, such as pre-cut vegetables and salads, are fine. When possible, avoid highly processed foods in bags, cans, and boxes. Plain frozen fruit and vegetables are great, since they preserve the nutritional value at peak harvest. But when possible, avoid frozen meals like burritos, dumplings, and pizzas. They tend to have lots of additives, are high calorie, and lead to overconsumption. Eat produce without gobs of meat, dairy, oil, and sugar. We joke that pizza has all the major food groups, but putting a salad on top of a slice doesn't make it healthier. Have a salad instead. While we should eat more fruits and vegetables, however we can't put the onus on individuals if for no other reason than 50 years of health advice is not working. Real change begins with knowing how big food is tricking us into thinking we are eating healthy when we aren't. Ultimately, we need to tear out the existing food system, root and branch, and create a culinary polyculture that serves the needs of humans and the planets. About the author, Arun Gupta is a graduate of the French Culinary Institute and has written for The Washington Post, The Nation, The Daily Beast, The Raw Story, The Guardian, and other publications. He is the author of the upcoming Bacon as Weapon of Mass Destruction, a junk food-loving chef's inquiry into taste, done by the New Press. The next article is entitled Self-Determined, Climate Resilience is Sacred. It's by Davis Price and Elimelech McFarlane, first published March 17, 2025. The drawing that illustrates this article is quite colorful. It's made up of a lot of circular shapes. At the top, we see a circle that represents the sun, and it's done with rings of yellow out through yellow-orange to a deeper orange shade. Near the bottom of this circle is another circle, and it is all green, and it has brown in it that indicates a tree with little lighter green dots on the ends of the tree branches. Then that circle goes into a blue circle, which has white drawings of lines that look like vine or leaves. Some of it looks like roots of a tree, and it's ending up with water at the bottom of it. And we see some fish in the water. On the sides of the drawing are two women. One is a person from Hawaii with a lei around her neck and also a ring of flowers in her hair. And the one on the other side of the page is somebody from Asia, maybe India. And she has a necklace, a broad-sleeved shirt on, and a veil that covers the back of her hair and goes down and flows into the water that was at the bottom of the page. Quite an intricate picture. As a tidal wave of authoritarianism crashes across the U.S., it may seem as if nothing is sacred, but in these moments of uncertainty, it is the sacred to which we must return. For the indigenous peoples of Mauna-Nuaki, across the water from our relatives on Turtle Island and around the globe, our fight for justice is rooted in our ancestral connection and kinship to the land, water, and earth. Our Kupuna ancestors have long practiced sustainable stewardship values, including Malama, Aina, care for the land, and Kuleana, responsibility to restore both our environment and our communities. Real climate justice work requires honoring indigenous knowledge and empowering grassroots efforts to protect our sacred relationship with Mother Earth. As we navigate a volatile economic and political environment, our resolve must be clear. Climate justice cannot take a back seat. We cannot abandon the decades of work to create healthier environments, regenerative systems, and economic opportunities in tribal, indigenous, and rural communities across the country. The fight for climate and environmental justice has always been led by indigenous, Black, and frontline communities because we have always been the first to experience environmental harm. The forced displacement of indigenous people from our lands was one of the earliest acts of environmental injustice, literally paving the way for extractive industries that have since poisoned land, air, and water. Today, fossil fuel projects continue to bring violence to indigenous communities. As a result, indigenous communities around the globe have always been, and continue to be, on the front lines, protecting our land and our communities. Climate justice is not a separate battle from racial justice, indigenous rights, gender equity, or economic justice. It is the through line that connects them all. Take, for example, the crisis of missing and murdered indigenous women and relatives, MMIWR+, which is fueled in large part by transient male workers in fossil fuel extraction camps near reservations. The MMIWR+ crisis is inseparable from environmental exploitation. Ending pipeline construction and mining projects is not just an environmental imperative. It is a necessary step to halt violence against indigenous communities, against women, and against our two-spirit relatives. When we view social issues through the lens of climate justice, we create pathways for real systemic change. Investing in renewable energy and land stewardship is not only about sustainability, it is about sovereignty, community resilience, and protection from the rising tide of authoritarianism. Knowledge for the future. Indigenous communities have long held the key to climate resilience. Traditional ecological knowledge, or TEK, offers regenerative models of land and water stewardship, ensuring sustainability for future generations. One example is Sacred Storm Buffalo in South Dakota, an organization revitalizing Lakota culture, increasing job and food security, and reconnecting people back to our land through regenerative buffalo ranching. Buffalo are native to this land and therefore have a symbiotic relationship with it. Their presence creates biodiversity in many ways. They graze the grasses down to different heights, providing nesting grounds for birds. They also roll around and pack down the soil in depressions in the ground known as wallows, which fill with rainwater and offer breeding pools for amphibians as well as sources of drinking water for wildlife across the landscape. And buffalo travel long distances to graze and find water, their sharp hooves churning the earth along the way, breaking up roots and aerating the soil to allow for new growth. Pre-colonization, 60 million buffalo roamed North America, supporting both the ecosystem and indigenous lifeways. The U.S. government nearly wiped out the buffalo in a deliberate strategy to starve indigenous people. Today, native-led projects like Sacred Storm Buffalo are restoring buffalo populations, reviving local economies, and rebuilding the biodiversity. Similarly, Kumano Aikiahala, K-I-K-A, in Hawaii, is restoring indigenous farming techniques to grow staple foods like kalo or taro. Before Western contact, Hawaii was a fully autonomous island nation, supporting nearly a million people through the Ahupua system, a sophisticated land management approach that connected mountain agriculture to shoreline aquaculture, ensuring ecological balance and abundant resources. Pre-colonization, Native Hawaiians used regenerative farming techniques such as diverting stream water to nourish wetland crops before returning nutrient-rich water to the ocean, which in turn sustained thriving fish ponds. Colonization and exploitative plantation agriculture, particularly sugarcane, dismantled this system and caused widespread environmental and cultural devastation. The U.S. military and modern tourism industry has exacerbated environmental harm even further, creating the conditions that led to the devastating Maui wildfires and continued to cause shocking levels of homelessness among Native Hawaiians. Today, KIKA is revitalizing traditional farming practices, restoring ecosystems, and producing culturally appropriate food to support Hawaiian communities. And by teaching youth 21st century versions of traditional farming practices, they're also strengthening cultural identity and mental health, providing young people with a sense of belonging. These are just a couple examples of indigenous-led efforts proving that climate solutions already exist and make sense for our environment, our communities, and our economy. Indigenous communities are developing solutions to mitigate the climate crisis based on real-time experiences coupled with generational knowledge that is rooted in relationship with their environments. Supporting solutions. With government agencies and programs being gutted on a mass scale, leaving countless organizations and efforts unsure of their futures, the role of the private sector has never been more urgent. Private foundations, high net worth individuals, and philanthropic organizations must step in to close the funding gap and ensure that communities on the front lines of the climate crisis are not abandoned. We need strategic investment in climate resilience, indigenous land stewardship, community-led sustainability projects, and the frameworks and strategies that Indigenous, Black, and frontline organizers have spent decades developing. The Bloomberg Foundation, for instance, has committed billions to combat climate change. This must become the norm, not the exception. Philanthropy alone is not enough. We must also strengthen grassroots networks by increasing our resilience efforts. Every community should be asking, how can we become more climate resilient? How can we build mutual aid networks that support people during climate disasters? How can we use climate action as a tool for broader social change and economic empowerment? How does our existing work shift if we look at it through a climate justice lens? Indigenous communities are developing solutions to mitigate the climate crisis based on real-time experiences coupled with generational knowledge that is rooted in relationships with their environment. Investment in climate justice in Indigenous and rural communities helps those communities become energy sovereign. It helps communities access affordable and healthy food, and it creates regenerative economic opportunities. It just makes sense. Mitigating climate change is not a new endeavor for Indigenous, tribal, and rural communities. We already hold the knowledge necessary to navigate the next phase of the climate crisis. What we need now is unwavering support from philanthropists, from organizers, and from every person who believes in a just future. Climate justice means food security for all, clean air and water for all, the development of clean energy on tribal lands, and protection for our Mother Earth. Climate justice is racial justice, Indigenous sovereignty, and the path to liberation for all people and Mother Earth. We must lock arms and stand for all that is sacred now. About the author, Davis Price is an Ohi Hawaii, Native Hawaiian from Oahu, Hawaii, and the director of NDN Collective's Climate Justice Initiative. You have been tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. From Flagstaff, I'm your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder. Thanks a lot for listening.